Hi there, I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and today you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. I'm honoured to have Luke Tobersky here as my guest. Luke is an endurance athlete and has led most of his life as one big adventure. Luke has done some crazy things, amongst which Marathon du Sable, where he almost lost a toe. He has run ultra marathons, and as well, he's written books and stands on stage and inspires audiences in terms of mindset and going on to achieve amazing things. Luke, it's an honor having you here today, and thank you for being my guest on my show. You were described in 2016 by Forever Sports magazine as one of the fittest athletes on this planet. Can you tell the audience a little bit more about your background and how you became the fittest athlete out there?
Oh, it's an interesting list to be a part of, but thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a complete pleasure. So basically, I do extreme ultra endurance challenges, from running down Mount Everest, running across deserts, cycling for over 16 hours non-stop, and then I did a thing called the Ultimate Triathlon, which was a 2,000 kilometer in 12 day swim, cycle and run from Morocco to Monaco. And when I completed this unbelievable self-created adventure, and that's when Forever Sports mentioned me in their list.
And this actual marathon, was this a race against other people, or was this something that you did yourself? Or?
Yeah, so the Ultimate Triathlon was something that I created. The route had never been done before as a swim, cycle and run. So I swam the Gibraltar Strait between Africa and Europe. Okay. And then I cycled the entire southeast coast of Spain along the Costa del Sol. And then the plan was, which I'm not going to reveal why I say this, but it was to run 14 marathons in 7 days across the south of France. I had a documentary made about this challenge, and things didn't go to plan. But this was completely self-created. No one had ever done anything like this before, and I saw it as an opportunity to push my mind and my body to see what I was capable of.
Wow. So can you divulge what happened?
Yeah, so basically I got completely exhausted, I got drained, I got injuries that set me back. At one stage, I was cycling for about 75 kilometers with no recollection. Even now, 4 years later, I have no recollection of when I was cycling at this point of time for 75 kilometers on a bike. I was on and off Spanish motorways because I had a tracker that was working, that wasn't working. My crew lost me, and it was late into the night. So I'd already been cycling for about 14, 15 hours, and they lost me for 75 kilometers, so about four hours. And then they found me towards the end of where I was supposed to be, and I was, I don't want to say I was unconscious, but I was unresponsive. And we didn't know how I didn't crash. So then this was a big thing, because I was like, do I push on? Do I go again? And I was like, yeah, next day, keep going. So there's that twist of what happens from there. And then also when I was running, when I finished the bike leg and I got on the run leg, I tore my quadricep, or three of the four quadricep muscles. And I continually to push myself to get to the end. And I covered 2,000 kilometers in 12 days from Morocco to Monaco, just not quite how I planned, but I did it all swimming, cycling and running.
And there must have been a point, I mean, you talk about practically having to give up because of injuries. What made you go on and carry on through all of these adversities that were happening? What made you sort of push through that?
Yeah, see, at the time I was escaping from life. I just retired from being a professional footballer, soccer player.
And so tell me about a little bit about that background. You're a professional footballer.
Yeah, so I grew up in Australia many, many years ago, and I played at elite level in Australia, and I bounced around the world after that, playing in America, playing in Belgium, playing in the UK in the lower leagues. Yeah. So people, especially here in the UK, you say you're a professional footballer, and they're like, did you play for Arsenal
or Manchester? Yeah, did you play for Newcastle?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a Newcastle fan.
Yeah, so I wasn't anywhere near that level, but I played in the lower leagues, but I was still getting paid to kick a ball around on a field on a Saturday afternoon. So I was a professional athlete, and after must have been in my late 20s, 26, 25, I started to get all these injuries when I was living in London. And then I would get fit, go to a club, break down again. And within this time, I was struggling with my mental health because I couldn't play the game that I loved, because I couldn't fulfill my athletic potential, and also because I just wasn't living the life that I wanted to live. So I was having a battle with depression, and I didn't speak about it with anyone because I was very, I didn't really understand what I was going through, but also, like, I felt shame that I couldn't talk about it. I was supposed to be this strong professional athlete. I'm not supposed to battle with mental health. Yeah. So I suppressed it for many, many years, and then it was at this point where my body kept breaking down physically. I was in a really dark place mentally that I decided that at the ripe old age of 28, I decided to retire from my life.
That sounds so funny, retiring at 28.
Yeah, and then I said, I'm going to be this big endurance adventurer. And that was it.
So literally from your professional footballer's days and going through this mental health issues and depression, you decided to go into being an endurance athlete.
Yep.
Okay, so what happened after that? Because it's...
So it's a funny story where I went from retiring from football to signing up to my first ever running race. And that gap, people think, oh, it might be a couple of months. It was literally about 2 hours.
2 hours?
Yeah. So I hobbled...
So you didn't sort of, you know, hesitate for a while, 2 hours?
No, not at all. So I hobbled home. And I was icing my calf muscle, which was the final straw that broke the camel's back in terms of retiring. And I decided, that's it. I'm done. I was icing my calf. And then my mind started to wander because I was in this dark place mentally and I wasn't able to fulfill my potential. I had this chip on my shoulder as an athlete. Like, I didn't really feel like I got the most out of my body as an athlete. And also I was trying to run away from life. So I did the only logical thing at the time, I thought, was Google this race that a friend of mine told me about a couple of years ago that was through the middle of Sahara Desert, and I found it. It was in 6 months, and I called them up, and I said, can I have a place? And they were like, if you pay your deposit now, and I was like, sure, and literally my life savings got transferred into this deposit for this race, and I hung up the phone and went, holy, I'm doing the Marathon des Sables, which is the equivalent of 6 marathons in 7 days through the Sahara Desert in 6 months' time.
So you're icing your calf, giving up your professional football career, and decide to do the Marathon des Sables.
I thought it made sense at the time.
Wow. So Marathon des Sables, I've heard a bit about it, and I've actually, funnily enough, I've been to the end of that race in the Sahara, and I've seen the guys that are crossing the finish line. I was in tears. It was a very emotional experience because these people are just practically dragging themselves through the sand after being 7 days. How was that for you? What experiences did you go through?
Ooh, I learned a lot about myself in those 7 days. I went out there, as I said, with 6 months of training and research and understanding how I needed to get from point A to point B at the end of each day and also at the end of the 7 days. And as I said, I was out there to run away from life. So I really punished myself. I was running hard. I wanted to finish in the elite top 50, which is this sort of like tagline for the top 50 athletes. And I went for it. And I went out really hard. And I think I did everything right in terms of my preparation, apart from I overtrained a little bit. So I had a few niggles going into the race. But then also the other thing I didn't know until I got out there was my feet sweat quite a lot when I run in hot climates, which I didn't know because I've only ever played football, so 90 minutes you're done. But after several hours of running in that heat, my feet sweat a lot. So what happens when, like, you're in the bath and you're spending too long in the bath, your skin gets really
wrinkly,
soft,
yes,
and
yeah,
really wrinkly. So then I'm running along on day 3 and I've got these blisters because all my skin's soft and it's rubbing. I take my shoes off and literally 2/3 of my little toe has just been degloved.
Oh.
So it's just red, raw, infected, and the big chunk of skin has just basically come off. And that was the end of day 3. I had a double marathon to do the next day.
So you continued with this toe hanging off?
Yeah. So there's doctors out there and they patched it up as much as I could and as they could. And then I set off and did the double marathon. And after 25 kilometers, I was extremely dehydrated and had no idea who I was or what I was doing. So they forced me to have an intravenous drip as well, which is something that not too many people can say they've had, an intravenous drip in the middle of the Sahara Desert. And then I continued on to finish that day. All the while, I was fueled with the whole point of I'm running away from my life. I didn't know how to face up to the fact I wasn't a footballer anymore. I hadn't grieved in that process. Mm-hmm. I hadn't put that to bed, so to speak, and moved on. It was still there. I had this massive chip on my shoulder, so I wanted to prove to myself that I was still a good enough athlete to achieve something. And I was really practicing self-harm every single day when I was out there trying to push myself to finish this race.
So obviously you're going through all this pain, you're going through these depressive thoughts. I mean, what really got you through? I mean, it must be some sort of determination to push you through those few days.
Yeah, so there's several levels to this. There's one level that I truly believe there's no one else in the world more mentally tougher than I am. Now, you have to think about that. I'm not saying I'm the most mentally tough person in the world. I'm saying I truly believe there is no one more mentally tougher than me in the world. So I have that self-belief, and that's from my past experiences, but also the amount of mental preparation that goes into any big adventure I've done. And even as a kid in sport growing up, I've always done mental strength training, whether it be meditation and mindfulness, visualization, self-talk, things like this. I grew up at elite sports in Australia when this was all part of your training. You know, this was like in the mid-90s.
So you would take time to meditate as a professional before you became a professional footballer?
I started meditating when I was 15, and that was sort of mid-90s.
Wow. I mean, I do a lot of... I can't... Meditation for me is amazing, and I would absolutely advise anyone to do it for various different things. But I wouldn't have thought as a 15-year-old sort of football player that that would be high up on your list of things to do.
Well, that was the level of sport that Australia was at during the mid-90s, because we put a lot of money into sport. And so I was at the elite level in that. And it wasn't called meditation at the time, because... You're saying that to a 15-year-old kid in the mid-90s, and like,
what the heck?
You meditate in India, like, yeah, we're in Sydney here. So it was breathing exercises, and it was like, if you have thoughts, acknowledge them without judgment and let them go. Okay. And it was different things like different breathing exercises and focus exercises and things like this, as someone was guiding us. And then it was like, okay, can you do this every morning? Can you do this every evening? And then if you are feeling a bit overwhelmed, can you stop and have this process of different breathing exercises and different thought exercises as well? And that was just the level of sport. That's what Australia was investing into back then. So I was exposed to this early on, and we worked with sports psychologists as teenage kids at the level that I was playing at, the clubs and the representative teams, and they started to give us these ideas of like positive self-talk, visualization. And I've used them my entire life. I've tweaked them in many different ways, but it's always been constant with me. So when I get to day four of the marathon, the Saabs, even though the reason why I was doing it wasn't the thing that I was focusing on, but I knew that I'd done the mental work before I got there. So from a mental strength standpoint, I had copious amounts of strength to get me through any setback I had or any obstacle that was faced in front of me. And that was because this has been something that I've been training since I was 15. I'm now 36. So I've got quite a few years of experience of how to train my brain.
So Luke, after Marathon de Sable, was that it for you? Or did you go on to do other things?
It was the beginning. Yeah. So that was my first ever race of any type. And then literally, so that was 2012. The ultimate triathlon from Morocco to Monaco was 2015. And within this 3.5 year period, I literally went out to create a business, if I'm honest. I wanted to change my life in terms of how I was going to live it, from both a personal standpoint and also a professional standpoint, because I wasn't a footballer anymore. I was training a few people in terms of running and health and fitness, because I've been involved in the health and fitness world ever since a teenager. And I've got a degree in exercise science. So I was doing that on the side to help make a bit of money. But I went, right, I'm going to be this endurance adventurer. That was the vision. That was what I'm going to do. And I was like, okay, what does this mean to me? Well, I'm going to do big challenges all around the world. okay? And I'm going to have other people pay for them. How? Well, I'm going to write magazine articles and have the magazines pay for this. I'm going to write books. I'm going to have documentaries. I'm going to be a speaker. I'm going to speak around the world all about these big challenges. And all the while, I'm going to create this profile that is going to enable me to then get sponsorship for big challenges as well. So I set out to basically spend any cents that I had, like any money I had, to do these big adventures. One adventure, and then whatever money I made from that, or if I had that covered, then I would go to the next one. And I invested everything I had, time, effort, money, into doing all these big challenges over a 3.5 year period, because I believed when I did the ultimate triathlon that I'd have a documentary made about it, I'd write a book about it, and I'd be speaking by this stage all around the world. I had this big pipe dream that this was how I was going to live my life. And then after the marathon de Sarbes, that was it. I went out to start doing it.
And did it happen? Did you get sponsorship? Did you get the money to do all these races?
I did big things, like I ran down Mount Everest in the world's highest ultra marathon. I did ultra marathons from 50 kilometers to 100 miles. I did a double Ironman triathlon in North Wales, taking 35 non-stop hours without sleep. Cycled from London to Newquay, which is about 412 kilometers non-stop, just to learn how to surf the following day. Ran through a tropical forest in China with no food, water, or money. I didn't speak the language. That's for another time. And did all these big, big challenges. And I was inching forward. So I was riding. So when I went out to Nepal and ran down Mount Everest from base camp in the world's highest ultra marathon, I spent 2 weeks in the villages with some elite runners. Mm. And I came back and I wrote 2 magazine articles, features for different magazines. So I was like, okay, there's a little bit of cash there. I started to speak for free in 2013. And I got my first paid gig in 2014. So I was talking about my adventures and I was getting some coaching to become a better speaker on stage. I was writing a blog. I was writing magazine articles. I was pitching myself to all these different brands. I was getting free kit, not so much money, but I was networking. I was putting myself out there. And over like 4.5 years, about 4 years, I slowly got to this place where the ultimate triathlon was about to happen. I was like, right, I need some cash because I want to have a documentary made. It's 12 days and I need to have a small crew. So I really needed to try and find some money, and no one cared.
So no one cared.
Yeah.
You're putting your body through these crazy adventures. I'm absolutely hats off to you. I mean, it sounds amazing what you went through and how you've pushed your body. But what was really happening for you, Luke Taberski? What was going on mentally for you? Because you're doing all these ultra extreme endurance to prove something to yourself time and time again. But what was actually going in? What were you thinking when you were doing all this?
So my ultra endurance career, there's 2 stages to it. The first stage is literally what I was just talking about. And it's a great question you just asked, because this will sort of tie it up nicely. Because it went from when I signed up to the Marathon de Sarbes to when I finished the ultimate triathlon. That's the first phase. The next phase is everything else after that. So what was driving me in that first phase, from when I signed up to the Marathon de Sarbes, the same day that I retired from football, to when I finished the ultimate triathlon, was this whole running away from life. I had a chip on my shoulder that I didn't feel like I fulfilled my potential as a footballer, as an athlete. So I had this massive chip that's like I had to prove to myself. And also it was a way of self-harm because of my mental health. I didn't speak about it with anyone at this time still. The first time I ever opened up to someone was early 2015. So I was battling 2009, 2010, really dark 2010, 2011. I didn't open up until the start of 2015, when I first went to see a therapist. And that was the first person I told.
And how did you know, or what made you take that leap to go and see a therapist?
Standing on tops of bridges, not wanting to be here anymore, multiple times, binge eating as well, and realizing that when I'm battling with insomnia, sleeping 5 or 6 hours a week.
A week.
Yeah, some nights I wouldn't even go to bed.
And this is while you're doing your training, running, and needing the energy.
Coaching other people as well, speaking on stage about eating healthy, eating real food, and then I'm binge eating in the nights, not sleeping, having insomnia. And also,
it's actually a wonder that you're actually still alive.
To a degree, it is. To a degree, it is. And I would not sleep, and it would be like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go for a run. And I would run for 4 or 5 hours. The sun would come up, and be like, great, I'd have breakfast and start my day. And I would tell my friends who I was living with at the time.
So you're running instead of sleeping?
Yeah. And cycling. I was out cycling along small country lanes out near where I live at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and cycling hard, not just sort of having a nice little Sunday cycle, not caring if I come off, and just pushing myself. So this was my way of self-harm. And this was what, it's that whole, I feel really low, so the only way I can feel high is when I do exercise.
The endorphins, pushing myself. Right?
It's a chemical endorphin rush. But then also in reality, this is me self-harming myself.
Yeah, completely.
Because I am ashamed of what I'm going through. And I'm binge eating, and that makes me feel good, and that makes me feel bad, and then I do more exercise, and it makes me feel bad, I'm not sleeping. It's this circle of feeling good, feeling low, feeling good, feeling low.
And using exercise as a way where many may use alcohol or drugs or other recreational
things. It was no different. No different. I was addicted to ultra endurance sport, so doing these big challenges, I was addicted to it. That was my drug of choice. And it was a way of self-harming. As you said, whether it was drugs or alcohol or gambling, their drug of choice was that. People who suffer from that with addiction, that's what their drug of choice is. The highs and the lows, I got the same thing from going out for a 6-hour run and starting at midnight.
Tell me, do you think there is a certain type of person that looks for that fix? So if I've been in the city for about 20 years, come out the corporate environment, and you see a lot of particularly males, women as well, that turn to these triathlons, these marathons, these races. I almost feel to escape their day-to-day job. Do you think there's sort of a connection there between the escaping for something or the endorphins or going through that, as you say, self-destruct, where their life is maybe meaningless?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of elements to this. The environment that they're in, say, in the city, and it's fast-paced and it's hard and you get this reward at the end, you know, whether it's payment, whether it's a new deal, whether it's a new contract or a new car or whatever. So I think the environment that you're in, and a lot of people who do endurance sports, they are type A type people who like to work hard, because the thing is, to prepare for a Ironman triathlon, let's say, you have to put the work in. So if you're not a professional athlete, you're working, say, 40, 50 hours a week, right? And then you've got to do, let's just say, really on a low-end scale, 10 hours, 12 hours of training a week. Then you've got life commitments, like, you're type A, this is perfect, because it's like, I don't want to stop. I don't want to stop. I want to go, 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 go. I've got to train at 6 o'clock in the morning, then do my work, and then maybe do a lunchtime run, and then do a cycle at night, and this is my day, times 7. This is great. At work, they not stop, non-stop, non-stop, go, yes. Go, go. So it's what they're used to, because they have to do the preparation. If you want to be a 10K runner and just do it for your health, you don't really need to do a huge amount of preparation. Maybe a couple of times a week you go for a run on the week and you do a 10K, great. So I think it's the people who like to never switch off, or maybe haven't found that stage in their life to be able to actually stop, take a step back with reflection and realize what's actually important to me, how do I want to spend my life, but even more so, why am I doing this? What is the deep-rooted driving force, the fuel source, whether it's positive or negative, that's actually pushing me to do this sort of behavior?
Well, I think you've just nailed it. But have you nailed that for you? Have you actually realized why you're doing this? Have you done some self-analysis on?
Yeah, so we've done the phase one of signing up to the Marathon des Sables to then finishing the Ultimate Triathlon. Now, because of the Ultimate Triathlon and everything else leading up to the Ultimate Triathlon, those 3.5, 4 years, at the end of it, my body shut down. So I went on this prescription of natural remedies for about 12 months to try and get my body back to normal. And it was really a lot of recovery in terms of the physical element, but also reflection in terms of the mental element of what I was going through. And it was only then that I faced up to the fact that I actually haven't grieved about retiring from football. Mm. It's still there, it's still on my shoulder. I've got this massive chip on my shoulder. So I was like, okay, I went through a grieving process to emotionally disconnect myself from football because I still had this emotional connection 4 or 5 years on. So I needed to actually go, I will always love you, football. You're always going to be in my life. You help me see the world. I've got friends all over the world. I didn't have a real job. I still haven't got a real job. But I, you know, in my 20s and in my teenage years, I didn't have to go and work in a supermarket packing shelves because I got paid to play football. Oh, wow. So I appreciated this so much. And it was not until I actually did this process of grieving to detach emotionally from football, it was like, oh, I feel relaxed now. I feel like it's gone. And then it was a case of I started to open up about my mental health. I started to talk about with my family and friends. I had another therapist at the time and I opened up about this and everyone was supportive. And the shame I felt, I almost like let go of that. And then it was like, why am I self-harming myself doing these things? So I was pushing myself physically too hard and mentally. And it was only in this time of 18 months where I stopped to let my body heal, but also reflected on why I was doing it and understood this and extracting knowledge from all the experiences I had to then start going, okay, I'm going to stop looking back and starting looking forward. Go, I'm going to use all the knowledge that I've gained through this reflection. Now, how do I want to live the rest of my life?
And how do you want to live the rest of your life?
So what I came about was through much reflection and sort of understanding myself was I started with a life philosophy. It was something that I first heard from Coach Carroll from the Seattle Seahawks, an American football team. He talks about having a life philosophy and it's basically how you live your life every single day, how you spend your time. It's a guiding set of principles, a word, a paragraph. And he talks about having a life philosophy, I think it's a personal philosophy, his exact words, in under 20 words. And I was like, right, I'm going to do this. And my first life philosophy was a page. I was like, how do I want to live my life? Like words, phrases, sentences, and things like that. And I got it down to building relationships, learning daily, and teaching others what life has taught me. When I wake up in the morning, we've all got 1,440 minutes.
Every single worked day. It out to the minutes.
1440. We have this amount of minutes every day. So how I spend that time, it has to line up with my life philosophy. So if I'm going to spend time, effort, money, and connect people within my network, if it doesn't line up with building relationships, learning daily, and teaching others what life has taught me, then there has to be a really big reason why I'm doing this or why I'm spending this effort, time, and money on doing this thing that's been put in front of me. When you know how you want to live your life and how you spend every single moment of every day, when you have these guiding lights, life becomes really simple. Because when someone says, hey, do you want to come and do this? And you're like,
does it fit into my life's philosophy, those three things?
Or, no, yeah. It doesn't. And the other thing, so that was a life philosophy thing. That was massive for me. The other thing was is knowing why I want to do what it is I'm spending my time and my effort and my money on. And I realized that at first there was two levels of whys. There was the superficial and the deep-rooted. But then I played around with this for a period of time and I realized there's actually three levels and I've called it my why tree. Now, you and I have spoken about the why tree before.
We have spoken about the why tree and lots of people do talk about their why, but I was interested to hear about your philosophy on it. And
so if people are going to ask me to do something or if I'm going to do something, so my next big challenge or another big challenge, you know, why do I want to do these big challenges? I have to have a complete why tree. And the why tree is this, there's three levels. There's the leaves of the tree. Okay? Mm-hmm. They're the superficial whys. They're the shiny things. They're the things that first grab your attention. They're important. They complete the tree. and they're fun.
So
and
it could be like money or something. Money, car, like that.
World record, being the first, being the fastest, growing the biggest, getting an award, things like this. Okay, they're cool. We should have these. Okay, but then, are they going to get you out of bed every morning when everything goes wrong? Okay, so say it's in the middle of winter in the UK and I have to go out for a 4-hour run. It's dark, it's pouring with rain, it's 0 degrees. If I'm training for a running adventure, just for the fact that I want to be the first to do this run, is it really going to get me out of bed? No, probably not.
That's probably more comfortable.
100%. So the branch wires are the next level, okay, because the leaves are attached to the branches. Now these are structural, these are strong, these are sturdy. A lot of people think their deep-rooted wires, that their fuel source, are these branch wires. But they're the connectors. Okay, they are sturdy, they are structurally strong, and they are very important to you. But it's when we go down from the branches to down the trunk to then the roots. These are the deep-rooted wires. These take time to understand. We have to ask ourselves, okay, these branch wires, but why do we want to do this?
So presumably everyone's deep-rooted why is different.
Of course. So, and you have multiple deep-rooted whys as well. You don't just have one. Because where does the tree get its fuel from? From the earth, from the soil. And how does it do that? Extract it through the roots. So literally, you have to spend the time on digging down into why you really, truly want to do this. And when you do that, when you understand your deep-rooted whys, and you can have multiple, this is the fuel source that's going to get you out of bed in the morning to actually push past when everyone else is, oh, I couldn't be bothered. And when you get hit with obstacles, when you have to adapt to setbacks, and when you need to see opportunities that you never saw before, when you know these deep-rooted whys, they're powerful and they help you create clarity. And I truly believe that when you have clarity, it's the eternal energy that will fuel your dreams and your goals. When you're clear of what you want to achieve, these deep-rooted whys help you create clarity. You need the branch wires and the superficial ones to get you going at times when it's difficult. But when you have all three, whoa, it's powerful.
So in terms of your whys and the tree that you just explained, is this something that you get up on stage and talk to other people about? I know that you do a lot in terms of mindset and helping people with, you know, looking at their mind and how they that can help them.
100%. So I speak across a range of industries, from sport to startup tech companies to event management to property investing, everyone. And I don't like to just get on stage and talk about my adventures. Like, they're great, that's cool. But I like to give people tools that they can go away and use. So I always start with people have to know why they want to do what they want to do. And the other thing that I like to talk about as well is that we all need to eat salad for breakfast.
Eat salad for breakfast.
Exactly.
I'm a big protein eater, but eating salad for breakfast?
So what I've learned from my big ultra endurance challenges, and remember we talked about before, is that when I retired from football, I wanted to be this endurance adventurer.
Yes.
And I wanted to go through and write magazine articles, documentaries, yep, made, speak, yes, on stage. And people would tell me, you can't do that. I'm like, why not? It's not a real job. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. But why do I have to get a real job? This is where I'm passionate about. This is what I want to try and do. And I looked at it as an investment in myself. And now that it's gone full circle to today in 2019, it's like that dream I had, it was a dream in 2011.
Yeah.
I'm fulfilling that. Everything that I wanted
amazing
to do.
Amazing.
I've wrote magazine articles to magazines and had features all published all around the world. I've got documentaries out, I've got a book published, I speak on stage around the world. I've done it. But if I listened to everyone back then that said, well, you should just get a real job, when are you going to face up to the fact that, you know, you've got to get out there and be an adult, you know? And it was like, no, like, I want to eat salad for breakfast. And this was just something that popped into my head at the time. So what I've learned from my whole career of an endurance adventurer and then as an athlete as well, is that you don't have to fit into the mold.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what eating salad for breakfast is. It's abiding by society's laws, because we've got to, okay, but not by its rules. So the reason why I call it eating salad for breakfast is we're told what we eat for breakfast. You go to the supermarket.
Absolutely right.
Go to the supermarket and on boxes it says breakfast cereal. That's what we eat. Okay, you don't go to the butcher and it doesn't say breakfast food on a steak. Okay, so we're told that we should eat muesli and cereal and toast, and maybe on the weekend some smoked salmon and poached eggs. You know, we're told that this is normal. This is acceptable to eat for breakfast. Now, if you eat a salad for breakfast and you go out to the street and you ask people, is salad a normal breakfast? And they'll say no.
Unless you're a rabbit, of course, where they might.
100%. And they'll say no. And so, well, why not? Well, it's just not. Well, why? It's because society has put so many people into a box and says, this is how you need to act. Why? Because if everyone ate salad for breakfast, what would happen to the breakfast cereals?
So tell me, if people want to listen more to you and find out more about what it is that you do and maybe how you can help. I know you've written a book, which I wanted to just briefly talk about, but what other ways can people sort of look up Luke?
Yeah, so I've got a blog, I've got a podcast, it's all on luketaberski.com. And if you're interested in getting me to speak for your organization or anyone like this, you can get in touch with me via luketaberski.com. I'm all over social media, just with my name, Luke Taberski. But yeah, come and say hi, and you can see some of the stuff I've spoken about. And yeah, I speak on whatever the company needs, not just like I don't have a talk that I go and do and recite all the time. It's like if a company is struggling with direction, I talk about direction. If they're struggling with having clarity in what they're trying to do, we can cover that as well. And also, the thing that I love, and maybe it's for another time, but it's why failing is positive. You know, that looking to fail, actually going after it. And these are things that I speak about on a regular basis to organizations and corporations all around the world.
You've written Chasing Extreme. Do you have another book in you?
I've got multiple books in me. So Chasing Extreme is my autobiography at the age of 35, it was published.
Okay, so you're still a baby.
Yeah, so I need to do another 30 or 40 years of living before I pump out another book like this. But yeah, so everything that I've learned from my entire life, from starting as a 15-year-old meditating and doing reflection and mental strength training to a 36-year-old who's had a wide and varied life and spent a lot of time reflecting and meditating and pulling out how I'm able to overcome obstacles and adapt to setbacks and see opportunities where others don't, where I never used to. These three things is what I'm really good at. I'm not a great swimmer, I'm not a great cyclist, I'm not a great runner. I'm really good at these three things. So I've understood how I do that, and I've got principles and processes of what I go through subconsciously and consciously, and now I want to share those with as many people as I can. A couple of books, a few more talks, who else knows what could happen.
Any more races?
Yeah, any more races. I'm always looking to do big challenges. I've got a couple of other big challenges coming up this year. So yeah, everything goes through my website. So if you want to know what else I'm getting up to physically, then check out luketaberski.com and you'll see.
And I've got to ask about the hat, finally. So Luke is known for his hat. And
there we go.
If you see Luke with this hat on, he's usually running.
Exactly. So this hat started in 2013, and it was a bit of a joke. A friend of mine, we were at this store, and they were selling these funny hats, and a friend of mine said, oh, you should wear that on your next 100-mile race. And I put it on, and we took a photo. It was fun, and it's actually quite comfortable. And the propeller, where is it? It spins when I run. So when I run, it spins by itself.
Must be really annoying.
it's quite good. It makes people smile. It makes them feel good about themselves that here's this, you know, grown man wearing a multicolored propeller cap while he's running. And then it makes me smile, and then I smile to the next people who I see. Smiling's the way forward.
Definitely. And finally, Luke, I ask this to all my guests. If you were to write a message in a bottle that is going to be found by future generations, what would that message be?
Whoa, wow. Message in a bottle for future generations would be, live the life that you want and love everybody.
Luke Taberski, thank you so much for being on my show today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.